Chapter 8. Throughout the day the leopard ran under her foretopsail alone, and throughout the day the barometer moved up. The slackening of the wind that Jack had noticed before the sinking of the Vauxhallite continued, but the sea was still as high or even higher for a while, and there was no possibility of altering course more than a point, still less of heaving to. Jack lay there in his cot in the strangest state of daze. He knew that the ship was steering well and that she was in good hands. He knew that the pumps were gaining and that the carpenter had dealt with the shattered deadlights, while Killick and his mates were now restoring the great cabin where they had already set the stove to rights. And he knew there was a strong likelihood that the storm was blowing itself out, that the ship had come through and with all her guns aboard. If the Dutchman hadn't foundered when he did, they must have followed her water over the side. Yet all these things were at a remove. He knew them, but they didn't concern him much. The vision of the Vauxhallite on her beam ends, overwhelmed by that terrible sea, presented itself again and again to his inner eye. This was war. She had sought the battle. She had done her utmost to destroy the leopard. It was the biter bit, and his ship had accomplished a feat of great value to the Royal Navy and the Father Indies. But it filled him with a kind of sorrow, a strange, abiding grief. A light appeared, and he closed his eyes.
"Well, my dear," said Stephen, "you don't like the light." "Just so."
He put it behind a book, and they talked quietly for a while. It was, as Jack had supposed, a splinter that had wounded him. A 2-foot piece of oak with a jagged cutting edge, sent flying by the Dutchman's shot.
"I dare say it will give you pain in your head for some days," said Stephen. "The wound itself is spectacular, and it will spoil your beauty. But you've had many worse. It was Lord Nelson's wound, you know, your forehead hanging over your eye."
Jack smiled. He would almost have done without an arm to follow Nelson.
"Yet I do not quite like the bang the flat side gave you. There is some degree of concussion."
"Still, that's nothing to what the recoiling gun might have done. But for the interposition of St. John, you were mere pulp, of little interest even to anatomy. As it is, I have great hopes of your leg. Is there any feeling in it now?"
"Leg? What leg?" "Why, it's numb. Upon my sacred honour, it's numb."
"Never be perturbed, my dear. I've seen far uglier limbs preserved."
After a silence in which Jack seemed to lose all interest in his leg, he said, "Stephen, what's that round your neck? You wasn't hurt, I trust."
"It is a woollen comforter against the cold, knitted by Mrs. Wogan. The lively red is designed to increase the wearer's sense of warmth by the association of ideas. I'm much obliged to her."
"Which Mr. Grant asked, can he report?" said Killick, thrusting his head through the door and speaking in a hoarse whisper. Stephen stepped out and told Grant that the patient mustn't be disturbed. Disturbance might agitate his mind.
"Do you mean he's not right in the head?"
cried Grant.
"I do not," said Stephen. He disliked the man's eager tone extremely, his obvious willingness to believe the worst.
In any case, he was on edge from want of sleep, and when he returned to the sleeping cabin, his face had a wicked reptilian look. In his remoteness, Jack didn't notice it, however. He said, "After anything of an action, I always have the blue devils. This time's much worse. I see that ship broaching to and all her people. 500 or 600 men. I see her over and over again. Can you explain that, Stephen? Is it something in the physical line?
To some extent, I think it is,
said Stephen.
5 and 20 drops of this, pouring carefully from a bottle by the shaded light, will rectify your humours as far as physic can.
It's less disgusting than your usual dose, said Jack. I forgot to ask you, how was your night? How does your gypsy woman come along?
I cannot answer for Mrs. Boswell. The Caesarian section is no light undertaking, even without a hurricane. But if it can be fed, the child may live, the creature. It is, as you predicted, female, and therefore hardy. I was at a loss to know what to do with it at first.
There's the girl that waits on Mrs. Wogan.
There is.
But you will recall that she was transported for infanticide. Repeated infanticide. She's a little eccentric where babies are concerned, and I couldn't think her quite a proper person. However, I opened my mind to Mrs. Wogan, and she very handsomely offered her services. She tends it at present in a basket lined with wool, and begs it may be indulged with a hanging stove.
Christ, Stephen, how I wish Tom Pullings were here, said Jack, and drifted off to sleep.
In the wardroom, Brian and Babington were playing chess, while Moore and Benton looked on. Fisher took Stephen aside and said, "What is all this I hear about the captain's intellects being disturbed?"
Stephen looked at him for a moment and said, "It is no part of my function to discuss my patient's maladies, and if the captain's mind were in any way affected, I should be the last to say so. But as it is not, I may tell you that Captain Aubrey, though weak from loss of blood, is intellectually a match for any two men here. Nay, any three or four. Bread and blood, sir," he cried. "What do you mean by questioning me? Your manner is offensive as your matter. You are impertinent, sir."
He took a quick step forward, and Fisher fell back, appalled. He was sorry to have offended. He had meant no harm. If a natural concern had led him into impropriety, he would most willingly withdraw. With this, he edged round the table and hurried from the room.
"Well done, Doctor," said Captain Moore. "I love a man who can bite you vexed. Come and have a glass of grog."
Stephen turned his cold glare on the marine. But although he'd had a wicked night of it and great responsibility, and although his anxiety for Jack had made him savage, Moore's round, red, good-humouredly friendly face brought a smile to his own.
"I know," he said. "I was too hasty by half."
"To be sure," said Moore near the bottom of his glass. For a moment the owner's wits were all astray, and small wonder when you consider the knock he had. You may not believe me, but when I gave him joy of the victory, he said he could take no joy in it at all. The captain of a 50-gun ship to take no joy in sinking a 74. Clearly, for the moment, he was all to seek. But from that to say his intellects are disturbed, why...
The door opened, letting in a blast of freezing air, and Turnbull appeared, calling for a hot drink. He was covered with snow, which he distributed pretty liberally about the wardroom, beating it from his cloak in thick clots.
"It's come on to snow," he said. "Would you believe it? 1/2 a foot on deck and falling fast."
"How's the wind?" asked Babington.
"Dropping all the time, and the snow has flattened the sea amazingly. It began with rain and then turned to snow. Would you believe it?"
Grant came out of his cabin, and Turnbull told him that it had come on the snow. At first it had been rain, but now there was 1/2 a foot of snow on deck, and both wind and sea had dropped amazingly.
"Snow?" said Grant. "When I was in these waters, I never came south of 38, and there was no snow. The 40s are nothing but strong winds, storms, and pestilence. Believe me, and I speak with 35 years' experience, a prudent commander will never go south of 39 degrees. He'll find no snow up there, I believe."
Stephen found no snow in 43 degrees either when he came on deck early the next morning. But it was extremely cold, and he didn't linger more than the few minutes needed to show him that the swell, though heavy, had no breakers upon it, that the sky was low and dark, that the clouds moved evenly across it at no great pace, and that the albatross out there on the starboard beam was a young bird, perhaps in its second or third year. He turned to walk into the cabin, and as he turned he saw Herapath's head coming up the hatchway. Herapath caught sight of him and dodged back, his face quite altered. Stephen sighed privately. He liked Herapath. He regretted this young man's provoked and necessary betrayal, with its consequent suffering. But there was a friendlier face on the far side of the rail, an open, welcoming grin. "Good morning, Barrett Bonden," he said. "What are you at?" "Good morning, sir. New puddin' in for the mizzen. A fine, bright morning for the time of year, sir. I find it disagreeably chill. A dank and cutting air. Well, perhaps it is a little parky, too. Cobb here says he can smell ice. He was a whaler, and they can smell ice a great way off." They both looked at Cobb, and the whaler blushed, bending low over his puddening. "Ice," thought Stephen as he stepped into the cabin. "And perhaps the great southern penguins, eared seals, the sea elephant. How I should love to see a mountain of ice, a floating island. Killick, good morning. How is himself?" "Good morning, sir. Passed a quiet night and is as comfortable as can be expected." Comfortable, maybe, although he still seemed closed in and reserved. No doubt there was a good deal of pain in his head. Nausea, for sure. He couldn't touch the huge breakfast that Killick provided. But Stephen was pleased with the leg. And when Jack stated his determination to be on deck for the noon observation, he agreed, only insisting that there should be proper support and wool next the skin. "You may also receive Mr. Grant, if you wish," he added. "No doubt you are eager to learn the state of the ship. But you would be wise to speak very quietly and to keep your mind as calm as may be." "Oh," said Jack, "I sent for him the moment I woke and asked what the devil he meant by altering course without orders." There was the line, with an unguarded nod at the compass hanging over his cot and a wince of pain, pointing northeast and then north. Anyone would have thought I'd been killed in the action. I soon undeceived him. What a loud voice that fellow has. I dare say his mother was one of those bulls of Bashan. What is it?" "Which it's Mr. Byron, sir," said Killick, "asking may he report a mountain of ice to windward." Jack nodded and winced again. As Byron came in, Stephen rose, laid his finger to his lips, and left the room. The young man, quicker in wit than Mr. Grant, whispered, "A mountain of ice to windward, sir, if you please." "Very good, Mr. Byron. How far away?"
2 leagues, sir, bearing west-south-west or half-west.
"I see. Pray let the bell be muffled, Mr. Byron. It fairly goes through my head." The muffled bell struck through the day, in a ship that had grown as silent as the tomb. So silent that those near the hatchways could distinctly hear the mewling of Mrs. Boswell's baby on the orlop. It quietened when it nuzzled its red, crinkled face into its mother's tawny bosom, and Mrs. Wogan said, "There, poor honey lamb. I'll come back for her in an hour." "You're handy with these little creatures, I find," said Stephen, leading her back to her cabin. "I've always loved babies," said she, and she seemed about to go on. After a pause in which nothing emerged, Stephen said, "You must put on the warmest garments you possess before your walk, which I must ask you to take early today with Mr. Herdopath. You've looked yellowish and peaked these last days, and the air is extremely raw. I recommend 2 pairs of stockings, 2 pairs of drawers, drawn well up about the belly, and a pelisse."
"Upon my word, Dr. Maturin," said Mrs. Wogan, starting to laugh, "upon my word, you are beyond the pale of humanity. You tell me I'm not good in looks, and you name what cannot be named."
"I am a physician, child. At times my office sets me as far beyond the human pale as the tonsure sets a priest."
"So medical men don't look upon their patients as being of the same race with themselves?"
"Let me put it thus. When I am called in to a lady, I see a female body, more or less deranged in its functions. You will say that it is inhabited by a mind that may partake of its distress, and I grant your position entirely. Yet for me the patient is not a woman, in the common sense. Gallantry would be out of place, and what is worse, unscientific.
It would grieve me to be a mere deranged female in your eyes," said Mrs. Wogan.
And Stephen observed that for the first time in their acquaintance her composure was far from entire.
"Yet, do you recall that at the beginning of this voyage you were so indiscreet as to ask whether I might be confined?"
Stephen nodded.
"Well," said she, twisting a piece of blue wool, "were you to ask me now, I should be obliged to say yes. Perhaps."
After the usual investigation, Stephen said that it was too early to be sure, that her view of the matter was probably correct, and that in any case she was to take more than common care of herself. No stays, no tight lacing, no high-heeled shoes, no gross indulgence of any kind, no high living. Mrs. Wogan had been nervous and solemn up to this point, but the notion of high living in so desolate an ocean, half a pot of jam, 3 pounds of biscuits and 1 pound of tea, all that remained of her stores, made her laugh with such amusement that Stephen was obliged to turn away to preserve his character.
"Forgive me," she said at last. "I shall do everything you say most religiously. I've always longed for a baby of my own, and although this one falls a little awkwardly, perhaps, it shall have the best start that ever I can give it. And may I say," she added in a faltering voice, "how much I honour your discretion?" Even with Dr. Maturin I had dreaded this interview. Perhaps I should say this confession, with its almost inevitable personal questions. "You have been even kinder than I had hoped. I am so much obliged to you."
Stephen said, "Not at all, ma'am." But the sight of her eyes brimming with tears and full of confiding affection made him deeply uneasy, and he was glad when she went on with a gravity unusual in her.
"How I hope the rumour isn't true that the captain is dying. I've heard that dreadful muffled bell, and all the sailors tell Peggy it tolls for him."
"They're never in conversation with her again," cried Stephen.
"Oh, no," said Mrs. Wogan, who caught his meaning. "They only talk through the bars. Pray, how does he do?"
I've heard such a tale of blood and wounds. He was hurt, sure, and cruelly hurt. But with the blessing, he may do well. I shall say a novena for him. The novena had begun at noon, but Jack didn't appear. It was not so much that he was unequal to the exertion, nor that low cloud made observation impossible, as that he was fast asleep. A deep, lasting, healthy sleep, right round the clock, and farther still, while Killick and the cook ate the enormous meals prepared for him, meals they had designed to fill him with good red blood. He woke with less pain, and although he was still somewhat removed, a bar or so behind, as he put it, he felt a keen interest in the welfare and the whereabouts of the ship. His leg was coming to, and a little before noon the next day he stumped out onto the quarter-deck and viewed the scene with the liveliest attention, much the same attention with which he himself was viewed, though covertly, by his officers, the young gentlemen, and all those members of the crew who were not actively employed in the head. He saw a grey and misty sea with vapour rising from it, a smooth sea that heaved with a quiet swell, a low sky, but clearing here and there as the clouds, or rather sea fog, parted, showing pale blue above. The Leopard, neat and trim, slipping along through the smoking sea with scarcely a sign of her rough time apart from the mizzen top, which was still repairing. On the starboard quarter, a school of whales, rising, rolling, and spouting quite close, perfectly undisturbed. The quarter-deck beheld a tall, pale, strange-looking captain with a fresh bandage over his gaunt face, silent, uncertain in his movements. "Deck ho!" called the lookout. "Eye silent, 3 points before the larboard beam. Maybe a league." Jack stared over the sea, and there in the wafting mist loomed the island, half a mile across or so, with a tall triangular peak to one side. Noon was too close for any detailed inspection, but he did see that it was surrounded by a mass of floating blocks. He made his way to his usual place, leant on the rail, gave Bondon his watch, took his sextant, and stared aloft. All the officers, all the young gentlemen, did the same. If only the fog would clear in the north, there was a fair chance of an observation, and it was thinning out fast. The pale sun at its height broke through. A general of satisfaction, and Jack wrote his reading while Bondon gave him the time by the watch. Then came the ritual of noon, the acting master to the officer of the watch, the officer to the captain, Jack's grave make it so, Mr. Byron, and the hands piped to dinner. On the assumption that Jack was quite restored, the order was carried out with the usual hullabaloo. He clapped his hand to his forehead, turned, stumbled on his game leg and fell flat on the deck. They ran to help him, small thanks for their pains, and when he was upright, clinging to the rail, he said, "Mr. Grant, when the hands have had their dinner, we'll hoist out the jolly boat and the red cutter to fetch ice from off that island." "I beg your pardon, sir, but it'll run onto your coat," said Grant. Indeed, the wound had opened, and the bandage was soaked already, the red blood dripping down his face. "Well, well," he said testily, "Bondon, give me your arm. Mr. Babington, get that hairy thing of yours out of the fairway." He'd meant to ask Grant and the midshipmen to dine with him. He was fully aware of the importance of the invulnerable, infallible commander, superior to all mortal ills, particularly with a crew like the Leopard's, with some indifferent officers, and what was now so large a proportion of raw hands. and he'd caught the atmosphere of intense, doubting curiosity. But suddenly he felt that he couldn't bear an hour of Grant's loud, metallic voice, and he decided to put it off until tomorrow. Yet before his solitary meal, Stephen, having renewed the bandage, sat with him for a while, and to Stephen he said, "Here we are, do you see, in 42 degrees 45 minutes east, 43 degrees 40 minutes south. A good observation, and I checked the chronometers by a lunar only 10 days ago. So we can't be more than a minute out." Stephen looked at the chart and said, "The Cape seems a great way off. About 1,300 miles, give or take a score or so. Lord, how we did run off our easting with the devil at our heels." "It will take longer, I presume, to run us in again and bring us back to the Cape." "There's little point in going back to the Cape. It's less than 5,000 miles to Botany Bay, and down here in the 40s, with the likelihood of fair winds all the way, we may run them off in under a month. As for Hans, Mr. Bligh or the Admiral are as likely to supply us as the Cape. Our stores have held out very well. So rather than beat back or run north and west, I mean to carry on keeping to this parallel, or perhaps a little south." "No Cape," said Stephen. "No. Did you particularly wish to see the Cape again?" "Oh, not at all," said Stephen. And then, "But come, you poured all the water away. What do we drink during this month of yours?" "Dear Stephen," said Jack, smiling for the first time since the action, "there's as much fresh water a few miles to leeward as ever we could wish. If you'd been on deck for the observation, you would have seen it. A monstrous, fine, great island of ice, enough to last us 10 times round the world. That's why I had the ship's head kept southeast. You always find these mountains floating about the high latitudes, though I hadn't hoped for them quite so soon, this being what they call summer." Stephen may have missed the iceberg in the forenoon when he was deep in Mrs. Wogan's papers, she being walked by Herapath, but he wasn't going to miss it now. As soon as he was free, he put on his comforter, a pilot jacket and a woolen hat, borrowed Jack's common telescope, much as he loved Stephen, Jack wouldn't let him have his best, and found a sheltered corner by the shivering hens. He sat upon a coop and stared at the towering ice with great satisfaction. Far grander than he'd imagined, a most enormous mass, fretted at its base into fantastic shapes, deep bays, caverns, lofty pinnacles, overhanging cliffs. An ancient island, he presumed, decaying fast in its northward drift. Great numbers of detached blocks floated at its foot, and some fell from the heights as he watched. A deeply gratifying spectacle. The Cape was a disappointment, particularly as both he and Mrs. Wogan had relied upon it. Her papers were almost ready, and only a few pages of Herapath's transcript remained to be encoded. But now she was much quicker at her task, though she still used the inky, often-folded key that he'd copied on an earlier occasion to include in his own letter from the Cape. Such a letter from an agent put out to grass! "But still," he said, "Cape Town or Port Jackson, the end is much the same. Though I do regret the loss of time. If the British boobies do provoke the Americans into a declaration of war, they may weep for these lost months." Far over, where the boats were busy, a dark form hauled out onto the ice. He stared more intently still. A sea leopard? If only it would turn its head. God damn this glass! He wiped the lens, but with no good result. It was not the glass misting, but the fog that dimmed his view. A yellowish fog that presently increased so that the spires of the island came and went, showing like floating castles made of glass. The ice had been coming aboard at a fine pace, hoisted up with cam hooks, and there was question of using the other cutter, perhaps the launch. From what little Stephen retained of the conversation on the quarterdeck as it flowed past his inattentive ears, the officers were in disagreement. Over and over again, Babington said that when he was in Erebus, north of the Banks, he'd noticed that the current always set in towards an ice island. And the larger the island, the stronger the current. It was common knowledge in northern waters. Other voices maintained that this was all stuff, that everyone knew the current set eastward in these latitudes regardless. The southern hemisphere was quite different. Babington was only showing away with his Newfoundland Banks. He might keep that for his Newfoundland dog, or tell it to the Marines. The Leopard stood off and on for some time after Stephen had given up hope of seeing anything at a distance, and in spite of the apparently immobile fog, her topgallantsails caught enough breeze up there to send her along at a comfortable pace, so that she came about easily at the end of each of her short boards. Babington kept insisting in an earnest voice that something should be referred to the captain. Grant that he shouldn't be disturbed. The captain was far too sick to be disturbed. Eventually Babington came over to Stephen and said, "Doctor, do you think I can go into the cabin without doing any harm?" "Certainly, if you talk in a reasonable tone, and not as though your interlocutor was 7 miles off and he deprived of hearing. You may find that answer in the wardroom, Mr. Babington, where people interrupt you before you've opened your lips. But it'll not do in the cabin today, for you are to consider that loss of blood renders the ears preternaturally acute." 2 minutes later, Jack came out, leaning on Babington's shoulder. He looked at the sea and the fog and said, "Where's the jolly boat?" "Between us and the island, sir, right on the larboard beam. I saw them not 10 minutes ago." "Signal the cutter to follow, run down and pick them up. We don't want to lie here all day firing guns while they wander about in the fog looking for us. I don't like the look of this current, either. There'll be plenty of ice tomorrow and clear weather if this breeze goes on." The Leopard ran down, heaved to within 3/4 of a mile of the island, unloaded the jolly boat, hoisted it in, and waited a while for the cutter. During this time, a thin gleam broke through the fog, and although Stephen couldn't distinguish anything but a single giant petrel, he did have the pleasure of seeing even greater masses of ice fall from the high cliffs above the low-lying mist, masses the size of a house that either shattered at the foot of the mountain or plunged straight into the sea, sending up vast fountains of water. Scores of these monstrous great blocks. The cutter was hoisted in. Jack said, "Spritsail, foresail, topsails and topgallants. Give the island a wide berth with this damned current, then east-south-east." The watch changed. Turnbull came on deck, muffled like a bear. Babington handed over. "Here you have her. Spritsail, foresail, topsails, topgallants. Give the ice island a wide berth, then east-south-east." And Stephen, licking a piece of ice that was quite fresh, once again meditated upon the enormous amount of repetition in the service. Jack lingered until Turnbull had trimmed the sails and the Leopard was making 5 or 6 knots. Then he said, "Mr. Grant, come and take a dish of tea in the cabin. You'll join us, Doctor?" "Thank you, sir," said Grant, "but I'm sure you're not equal to company." Jack made no reply. He stared over the side for a while, trying to pierce the fog and see the iceberg out on the larboard beam, but it was gone. Then he led the way aft, holding Stephen's arm, and followed, rather awkwardly, by Grant. The awkwardness persisted throughout the tea-drinking, and it caused Grant to speak in a voice louder and more brassy than usual. Stephen was glad to escape.
"I shall sit with Mrs. Wogan and her stove for a while," he said, as he made his way down to the orlop.
He was on the top step of the lower ladder when he was flung bodily down to its foot. An enormous echoing crash seemed the cause, and the total arrest of the ship's forward motion. At once all the people below rushed over his body as they made their way on deck, and it was some time before he could gather his wits. He heard furious, contradictory cries of up with the helm and down with the helm, and a confused bellowing. Herapath came leaping below in two bounds with a spike in his hand. Seeing Stephen, he cried, "The key! The key! I must get her out from down there!" "Calm yourself, Mr. Herapath. There are no rending timbers, no evident leak, no immediate peril. But here is the key and that of the forepeak. You may liberate them if the water should rise." He spoke quietly enough, but Herapath's frantic dismay affected him to the extent of causing him to step into his cabin, make a quick, judicious selection of his papers, and put them into his bosom before climbing up to the deck. There he found an appearance of complete disorder, some men running aft, others running forward to join the vague, shadowy forms on the forecastle. The ship and everything around her were shrouded deep in fog, until an eddy of wind tore it apart. And there, high up above the masthead, he saw a wall of ice, soaring up and up, leaning out so as to overhang the deck. And its base, with the breaking waves, was not 20 feet away. "Haul of all!" came Jack's voice, loud and clear, doubled by the echo of the ice. The disorder vanished, the yards creaked round, the towering wall moved sideways, gently, on and on, until it lay abeam. Then the fog closed in, and a dead silence fell. "Foretogallant staysail," said Jack. "Rig the pumps." The sound of running feet and hauling died away. In the silence nothing could be heard but once the thunderous crash of falling ice some way to starboard, the grinding of the pumps, and the gush of water from the side. No one spoke. All on the quarter-deck stood motionless, and their breath condensing joined the silent fog. Silence, and the ship dead still, quite motionless. Then a vast rending that jarred the Leopard throughout her length and breadth, and she began to move. "Helm amidships," said Jack. "No helm, sir," said the quartermaster, spinning the wheel. Babington raced below. "Rudders beat off, sir," he reported. "We shall soon deal with that," said Jack. "All hands to the pumps." Now began a period of the most intense activity. Stephen saw sails taken in, others lowered down and sheets let fly. Mr. Gray or his mates kept running up to report the depth of water in the well, and presently Jack disappeared, hobbling with his arm round Bondon's neck. His face was firm and confident when he returned, but Stephen was persuaded that he had found a very grave state of affairs below. This impression was confirmed within the minute, for parties were taken from the pumps and set to lighten ship. Her precious guns went overboard, splashing into the quiet, misty sea through their open ports, their careful breaching slashed through with an axe. All the shot within reach, all the hard-won ice that was still on deck, the anchors cut from the bows, the great cables followed them, and cask after cask of provisions, all that were nearest to the hatchways, hours of furious toil. "How well they throw up the water," said Stephen to his neighbour on the pump winch. "Too bloody well, mate," said the seaman, who didn't recognise him in the growing dark. "The scuppers can't take it all. It's swilling about the deck, and if this fucking sea gets up any more, it'll pour down the hatch every time she rises." "Perhaps we shall exhaust it very soon." "Hold your jaw and pump, you silly bugger. You don't know nothing." The sea mounted. The wind blew stronger. Men were sent all along the lee scuppers to keep them clear and help the water over the side. But at last the hatch had to be battened down, and the lightning of the ship grew harder still. At midnight the cleverer hands were called from the pumps, and they set to in the waist, plying needle and palm by lantern light, sewing rolls of oakum to a stunsail that was to be passed under the ship's bottom to stop the leak. But still the pumps swirled on and on, and in time the night assumed an everlasting quality, heaving round the winch, poising on the roll in the darkness to thrust with all one's force was all that mattered in the world. At one point there was a general cheer at the report that the larboard chain pump was sucking, but they didn't stop for a moment. And although the report proved false, it was only a temporary blocking of the channel, the cry itself was encouraging. Once the extreme measures had been taken, the hands were relieved at regular intervals, and they trooped aft to the wardroom, where the purser and his steward had thin grog, biscuit, cheese and sausage laid out on the table. They all ate together, worn and exhausted by the toil at the heavy pump winches, and even more by the icy wind and the rain, but still hopeful, still cheerful, as though this were an unpleasant, long-lasting dream that would come to an end in time. The slow, grey morning showed a troubled, broken sea, a strong and rising wind. The Leopard, low and heavy, had lost her main topsail and her fore-to-gallant. Hands couldn't be spared from the pumps to furl them, and they'd blown to ribbons. Shortly after, the foretopsail followed them. Yet now the stunsail that was to stop the leak was over the side, and men with ropes on either gangway were working it along the bottom. The great question was to find the leak. For since the ship had first struck the ice stern on, and had then turned hanging on her keel, there was no telling what it might be. Grant was right out on the jib boom in spite of the heavy sea. It very nearly killed him twice. But he could make out no damage to the bows. And in the close-packed hold, deep in water, it was, of course, impossible to come at her bottom or her sides. But the likelihood was that the leak was in the stern where the rudder had received its blow, and they cut the deck to reach the breadroom right aft, hoisting up everything that could lighten the ship and throwing it from the wardroom window. For once the breadroom was clear, they could cut lower still, and perhaps find the leak down in the Leopard's Run. At the same time they worked on another fothering sail, since the first had had little or no effect. And all through these hours the pumps worked on as strongly as ever. Never a pause for a broken chain, never the least slackening of the general effort, although by now the seas were making a clean breach over the gunwale and soaking the hands as they worked. Each pump was discharging a ton a minute, a splendid gush. Yet all the time the water mounted in the well, 7 feet, 8 feet, 10 feet. It was when Mr. Gray reported 10 feet in the well that the starboard pump chain broke, and the poor old man had to turn to and unship the casing to get at the link. Hours of work in the darkness after his spell at the winch. And then, as soon as it was repaired, the small coal swilling about in the water below choked it. Stephen had now lost count of time. It seemed to pass round him or over him in a perpetual muddle and hurry, or at least with so many things going on at once that he couldn't keep track of them, though he was aware that some guiding intelligence directed the obscure movements in the darkness. The only thing that was clear in his mind, the centre of his physical and mental activity, except on those occasions when he was called away to dress a wound, was the pump, and the plane, direct, urgent task of heaving it round so that the ship should not sink. Now, with the team standing idle while it was being repaired, he stared stupidly for a while, and then followed them aft to the wardroom. Men had now been pumping so long and so furiously in this bitter rain and sleet that the moment they had a pause in the shelter, they fell asleep as soon as they'd eaten, or even while they were eating. Hours passed, The pump was repaired, and the midshipman in charge of it roused them all out. Another spell, and the heaving soon became mechanical again, the wind and the rain hardly noticed. Relief, deep and apparently momentary sleep, and they were called out again. After an indefinite period, Stephen noticed that they had prepared another sail for fathering the ship, and that they were going through the same laborious motions of passing it under her bottom, a long, tedious operation with innumerable orders roaring over the grind of the pumps. Being an animate cog in the machine was hard enough. The hardest, most prolonged physical exertion he had ever performed. He didn't envy the man who had to command the whole, adding extreme mental exertion to all the rest. With great labour, the sail was passed aft and bowsed taut. The leak still gained. Jack had been at the pumps all the time he could spare from the lightening of the ship and all the fothering. His leg hadn't allowed him to move about nearly as much as he wished, and he'd had to rely on Grant for much of the work and many of the instant decisions. And Grant had behaved extremely well. His heart warmed to the man. Grant knew his calling through and through. A real seaman. He was pleased with the Leopard's people, too. They'd worked nobly. Discipline had held after the initial panic. It was true that he and his officers had taken the greatest care that they shouldn't get at anything stronger than the thin grog in the wardroom. They'd toiled on and on, soaked in the wicked cold, with nothing to cheer them but one false report in a ship that already looked very like a wreck. Never had he seen pumps worked round so fast for so many hours together. But after his last visit to the well, and the report that he heard there, he wondered how long they'd hold out against the discouragement, the biting wind, and the physical exhaustion. Hitherto he'd been able to tell the men at the pumps something that he at least partly believed, and that heartened them. Now, returning for another spell, all he could produce was the old, "Huzzay! Heave round! Heave round! Huzzay!" Grant relieved him with the same cry, and he stumped to the wardroom for a bite. Here he found Stephen and Herapath, dressing a number of wounds, crushed fingers and the like among the men employed in getting the casks of flour up from the breadroom, and the women. He saw the women without surprise. By now the water was above the orlop. Above the orlop. The hold, quite full. And everyone knew it. Byron and three of the youngsters were down here too. In 5 minutes they would be rousing out the men of their divisions. Most of them had behaved well as far as he'd had time to see, carrying messages and coordinating the labours of the crew, though he had noticed some absences. One little boy was sobbing convulsively, but this was mere exhaustion. Jack had seen him on deck 5 minutes ago, running with a great load of cable junks. Byron silently passed him a piece of cheese. He took it, put it in his mouth, and dropped into a sleep, if such a stupor could be called sleep. But he jerked into consciousness when the relief was called, and returned through the darkness to the starboard pump on Bondon's arm. There were fewer men at their duty now. More and more were hiding. And these worked silently with much less strength. Hope was fading, if it wasn't entirely dead. He called out, "Huzzay! Heave round!" mechanically. And as he did so, he forced his mind to work out fresh ways of coming at the leak, and of steering the ship once it was stopped. Pakenham had made a rudder from spare topmasts. How he got through that night he couldn't tell. But after a stretch of darkness in which time had no meaning, there was Bondon, half leading, half carrying him back to the cabin. Before they reached it, the heat of hard pumping was all gone and the cold reached through to his heart. Here, Stephen dressed his wound and made him lie down, swearing to wake him within the hour. "'Sit on the locker, Bondon,' said Stephen, "'and drink some of this coffee. "'Tell me now, how much longer will they hold out?' "'He'd already heard much of the muttering, "'the frightened, exhausted men calling for the boats, "'for anything but pumping forever in a ship that must surely sink, "'that might sink at any minute, drawing them all down.' He'd felt the panic dread of that mortal plunge, the Dutchman's fate, and many a time he'd heard the words, unlucky ship.
I doubt they'll last out today, said Bondon. I'm in the hands that don't know the captain. They say the boats should have been got out right away. They say Mr. G knows these waters and will take them back to the Cape. They say the captain's not right in the head. I'll crown one bugger for that. Oh, beg pardon, sir. And, of course, they all know she's an unlucky ship.
Bondon's head drooped forward. From his sleep he murmured, They say Mr. G said something to Turnbull. But no more. Jack was awake, grey but alive, with Killick's good breakfast dispelling the cold, when Grant came to him, reported the water over the top of the well and gaining fast, and the parting of the new Fothering sail at the Clues.
So there we are, sir. We've done all we can by the ship. We cannot pass a new sail before she settles. Shall I provision the boats? I presume you'll go in the launch.
I do not intend leaving the ship, Mr. Grant. She's sinking under us, sir. I'm not sure of that. We may save her yet. Father the leak. Fashion a rudder with a spare topmast.
Sir, the hands have wrought hard, very hard, ever since the moment we struck. We cannot in honesty give them any more hope. And if I may speak plain, I doubt they'd come to their duty with the water deep in the orlop. I doubt they would still obey orders.
Would you still obey orders, Mr. Grant?
Asked Jack with a smile.
I will obey orders, sir. Said Grant, deadly earnest. No man shall ever accuse me of mutiny or lawful orders. But, sir, is it lawful to order men to their death with no enemy at hand, no battle? I respect your decision to stay with your ship, but I beg you to consider those of another way of thinking. I believe the ship must founder. I believe the boats can reach the Cape.
I hear what you say, Mr. Grant, said Jack.
He reflected. The discontented men would do nothing from this moment on. They certainly knew Grant's mind. There would be no point in putting down the mutiny, if mutiny this could be called, even if you could rely on the Marines.
I hear what you say.
I think that you're probably mistaken and that the Leopard will swim. But swim or not, I stay with her. Each man must do what he thinks right. If you think it right to go off in the boats, you may do so, and God speed you well. But you must see them provisioned.
What now, William? He said, looking up.
It was Babington, looking old, yellow, and destroyed. The boatswain's come aft with a party of men, sir. I said I thought you would see them, he said with a significant look. Shall I ask Captain Moore to step in?
No, I will see them. They wanted the boats, they said. They meant no disrespect. They believed they'd done their duty, but the barkie was sinking. They wanted to chance their luck in the cutters and the launch.
Yes, said Jack, you have done your duty.
No man could ask more. And it is true the ship is, in a very sad way, but I believe she has a better chance than the boats. At all events, I stay with her. I tell you again, I tell you fair, I believe she may swim. If you and your mates will go back and pump while we father her again, I promise you I will give Mr. Grant orders to prepare the boats. They will be there and ready if there is no hope for the ship.
There you are, Mr. Grant. He said when they were alone, that'll give you some hours to provision them. Launch and prepare both cutters. Leave the jolly boat. It'll be no use to you. Take what you need. But for God's sake, don't let the hands get into the spirit room. They would go. He was certain of that. Go even before he'd tried a new sail. Some of these men were mad for escape, even into open boats with 1,300 miles of sea between them and the Cape. And soon there'd been no controlling them by any means short of death. And there was nothing to be gained by killing men at this juncture. When Stephen came in, he said, "Stephen, the boat will soon be away, probably some time before nightfall. If you choose to go, pray dress up warm and take my waterproof cloak. They will take you, I know." "They? You do not go?" "No, I stay with the ship. But I don't wish you to feel the least obligation to remain if you had rather not. It is a matter of principle with you?" Jack nodded. "Listen, will you lay it plain before me now? I speak for some papers I have, not for myself. Principles aside, for I know your views on what is right in a captain, which is the better course? I may be wrong, but I still think the ship. Yet the launch may get through. Bligh took his boat farther, and Grant is an excellent seaman. He will certainly be in the launch. Then I shall give him what I can copy. Forgive me now, Jack, I must work as fast as I can. The ship is all on a buzz with this talk of the boats, and there are some fellows may break out in no time at all." Jack hobbled out onto the quarterdeck. There was still a fair semblance of order. A man stood by the useless wheel. The glass had been turned. The pumps were working steadily. The wind had lessened, and with it the sea. The Leopard, strangely low in the water, moved steadily on, her trim keeping the breeze on the beam. He called for the boatswain and gave orders for the launch to be hoisted out, then the cutters. The jolly boat was not to be touched. A long task, but efficiently carried out, the men working with a will. And all the time he was conscious of furtive looks darting at him from the men and boys on the quarterdeck. When it was done, he told Grant to see them provisioned, and went below to write to the Admiralty and the Sophie. It was when he came to this that the shift between himself and the present broke down, vanished entirely. It had been with him ever since that remote day of the Wirksamkeit, this sense of observing the world from a distance, and of moving, functioning more through duty than intimate concern. And the moment of its breaking, of his coming wholly to life, was exquisitely painful. At the same time, below him, down on the orlop, with the water washing about his shins, Stephen wrote like a man possessed, a summary that nevertheless covered page after page in close-written code. They were both of them jerked from their writing by a bawling, hallooing, rioting din. What Jack feared most had happened. Getting aft, uncontrolled for provisions, some hands had forced the spirit room door. Some were roaring drunk already, others were following their example. At much the same time, the larboard chain pump broke down at last, choked with the coal that had washed into the well. At once its team hurried aft, and at once the leak began gaining faster still. This was the end. In the event, the boat's parting was not a clear-cut division between those who wanted to go and those who, from duty or loyalty to their captain and trust in his powers, chose to stay. It was a period of very ugly confusion, panic in some, drunken madness in others, a period in which cabins were looted, boxes broken open, so that wasters appeared in laced coats and hats and two pairs of trousers, and men were killed or drowned as they tried to crowd into the boats. Some tried to launch the jolly boat, but Bondon and a score of his friends wouldn't let them. The division had a good deal to do with men's ability to hold drink. And some good hands who would have stayed an hour earlier now went over the side. Yet still, roughly speaking, it followed the line of attachment to the captain. Although there were some surprising sober departures. But with the spirit room open, the final stages were so squalid, so saddening, that Jack wouldn't look on at all. Having shaken Grant's hand, having given him the packets for England, and having wished him all that a sailor could hope for, he retired to his charts and his drawing of a jury rudder. Stephen stayed by the rail to the end. Sometimes they called to him to come into one boat or another, but he only shook his head. He saw the launch hoist a lug sail and stand away to the north. The red cutter, unable to step its mast, rowed after it, while the blue pulled back to the ship, catching crabs, falling about, and then ramming the side. They'd already lost their sails, and they bawled out for more. Someone flung a bundle of canvas into the boat, and perhaps a score of men with second thoughts, or with none at all, jumped from the ship's gunwale and chains. The last the Leopard saw of them as they went astern was the dark, struggling mass in the icy water, as those in the sea fought to get into the boat, and those in the boat fought to keep them out.